I'm Shannon. I'm an alcoholic. Requirements for chairing a meeting at the Central Orlando Group Saturday night speakers meeting are 1 year of continuous sobriety and attending a group conscience meeting, and I have done both of those. I started drinking at 15, and as soon as I put the alcohol in my system, I knew it was for me. I continued to drink for 19 years. I was a blackout drunk, and so I didn't have to drink every day, but I always knew when my next drink was going to be, and that's what kept me going. Again, at the end of my drinking career, the way I felt on the inside, because I didn't have a lot of outward consequences, but the things that I had done and the way I felt on the inside, the drink, the shopping, boys, whatever, couldn't fill that hole anymore. So it was suggested I took that test. I came in here, and I really just wanted to stop drinking. Well, I didn't really want to, but I knew I had to. And I came to a beginner's meeting on 6 o'clock on Sunday night. And I thought once I put down the drink that everything I did would change, and it didn't. And that's when I learned that I had to live with me and learn how to live life on life's terms without alcohol. And I'm truly grateful for what this program is doing in my life. I found a higher power. And I know that there is a solution other than alcohol today. And I know that no matter what I'm going through or what happens in my life, that God will carry me through it because he carried me this far and he won't drop me now. So I'm truly grateful to be here tonight. Thanks for help keeping me sober. The group asked me to remind you to please make sure your cell phones are off and to refrain from moving around or talking while the speaker is sharing. Which gets me to introducing our speaker. The first time I heard our speaker speak, he made me smile because it was his accent, I think. But I also went, ooh, I want to be like him when I grow up. Because what he said just touched me. And every time he shares, he touches me. And I know that he truly walks with God. And I know that he's a wonderful man. And he calls me little Dutch girl. I haven't quite figured out why, but I was so tempted to wear some Dutch shoes tonight, but I didn't want to get looked at like I was crazy. But I know that when he gets up here and starts talking, God will speak through him, and you will be touched by what he says. So with that, here's Jim.
Look at all these people. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Jim Powers. And it is an honor and it's a privilege to be here tonight. It's a privilege to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous to begin with. And I really appreciate Shannon asking me to speak. And I leak, so I got to find the Kleenex before I start. You know, Dr. Bob said that a long time ago, grown men don't cry, but we leak. So if I leak a couple times, it's because I really mean it. I am nervous. Some of you have heard me speak before. Some of you have been at meetings. A lot of you have been in meetings with me. I do have a very strong passion for Alcoholics Anonymous, and the main reason is it saved my life, and then it gave me a life beyond my wildest dreams, and I just can't pay it back enough. I can't pay it forward enough, and I'm more than happy to speak when I'm asked to, but I'm always scared to death that I'm not going to do it right or I'm going to leave something out. So I'm going to start off by telling you the only reason I'm here tonight is God's grace. I should be dead. I should have been dead many years ago. And for some reason, God saw fit to keep me alive for whatever reason. And I don't know the reason, and it's none of my business is what I'm told. You know, God wants me to know why I'm here. I'm sure lightning bolt will come down or something and tell me. But I'm here to share my experience, strength, and hope. I'm here for the newcomer. Because that's what I've always been told since I got here is I really don't have anything to give anybody except the newcomer. A long time ago when I first got in here, I went to the little room next door, and a gentleman named Leo, who kind of sponsored me for a while the first few years I was bouncing in and out of here, told me that, you know, don't go in that little room anymore. You don't have anything to offer all those people who've got sobriety in there. You need to be in the big room where the newcomers are. So this is why I've always been in this room. And he told me one day, he'd tell me when I could go back in the other room, and then he died. And I just never have been back in the other room. My sobriety date is February 18, 2002, and that is not the date that I came in here. Shannon did not know it. When she asked me to speak a month or so ago, I didn't know what day I was going to speak. I said yes, and then when I came in here the 1st of October and I saw it was today, she had no clue that, you know, there a few things happened on this day in my life that I remember. Number one, for the past 16 years, I've been in Georgia with a rifle in my hand every morning on this day. I'm a deer hunter, and if you don't like that, I'm sorry, but that's what I do. Maybe that's my accent that she likes so much, a redneck accent. It's also 11 years to the day that I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous. And like I said, I didn't come here with a nudge from the judge, as they say, or from detox or the emergency room or rehab. I kind of feel I missed out on all those things that some people got, you know. Maybe I ought to start over again and get all that. But I think God just brought me here for a reason, you know. And I didn't know what it was at first because I wasn't planning on getting sober. I didn't think I had a problem. And I'll get to that in a minute. It's also the day that a year ago today I got a phone call up in Georgia that was the catalyst for me coming back. And that phone call was my younger brother, who's 10 years younger than me, was in a coma from alcoholism, and he was getting ready to die. And he did die. And we didn't get the time that we thought we were going to get, but it's a deadly disease, people. It's a real deadly disease. I've been here now 11 years, but I've been sober just going on 8. And I've seen a lot of people that have come in this room that I've really got to know and got to like change their mind. And they've decided that they, you know, got well. They got well enough that they could go back out and start drinking again. And they didn't make it back in the rooms. And I'm really sorry about that. I really miss a lot of those people. And a lot of y'all knew who they are. But the only thing you're going to hear from me tonight that's original is my experience, what happened. You know, when I got here and what's happened to me now is all what I've learned in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, so that's nothing original when you start hearing things later on. But I'll just, I'll go through my story. You know, I was born on April 1st, 1954. I was born into a military hero and my mother, and they were not alcoholics. Most of my brothers and sisters were not alcoholics. The one that was did pass away last year. And we were in a military family. My dad was the commander, an Air Force commander, and we moved all over the place. And I knew that both my grandfathers were alcoholics, but I didn't know it when I was young. I knew it, you know, sometime when I got in my 20s. And my dad and my mom both were not going to be like their parents, their fathers. And so when my dad went up to Gainesville in 1942 on a scholarship to play basketball, and then, you know, World War II broke out, he signed up for the Air Force, and that kept him from becoming an alcoholic. He told me years later that you just couldn't be on standby flying airplanes and, you know, be having a hangover, be drunk, and, you know, he really credited that with him staying away from it. We moved all over the world. I was born in Atlanta, and then we went to New Mexico, and then we went to Japan. And I was thinking about this the other day, that the longer I'm sober, the more I can remember. And I don't know, you know, that's funny or not, but it really is, you know, because I can remember things that I used to forget. And when I was 10 years old, before I ever had a drink, we lived in Tacoma, Washington, McCord Air Force Base. And a little friend of mine and I were coming home from school, and there were some woods between the elementary school and the housing project there, and we caught a little mouse. And, you know, we were playing with it, and we thought it was kind of cute, and we put it in a little backpack or whatever we had to take home, and my friend got, you know, just nipped on the finger. And he went home, and all of a sudden, you know, if you live on a base, everybody knows what's going on, especially the commander's wife and everything. And my mom got a phone call from his mother, and she said, "You and Bobby found a mouse." And I, "Yeah. Did you get bit?" I'm thinking to myself, maybe I can get out of school on this one, you know. So I said, "Yeah." Yeah. Holy crap, man. this is a long time ago, people. I just want you to know I am a little bit old. And back in those days, what they had to do is cut the mouse's head off and send it to Washington, D.C. to see if it had rabies. And in the meantime, you got to go every day to the base dispensary and get a rabies shot. So that was really stupid. You know, here I am lying at 10 years old thinking I'll get out of school, and I'm telling my parents, look, I got no bites. I really, you know, I was joking. And if you've never had a rabies shot, try not to get them. They hurt. And it was 11 days before that test came back from D.C. You get 13 of them. It's a series of them. And I got 11 of them. Every day I had to go get one. And luckily, because I've talked to people who had them in the stomach where they originally gave them, apparently I lucked out. I had them in the arm, but your arm would swell up about the size of a softball every time. And, you know, I just look back on it now and I go, geez, before I even drank alcohol, I was an alcoholic. You know, I was trying to get out of school and here it was. You know, have some fun with that. The next year we moved to Duluth, Minnesota. I don't know what my dad did wrong, but apparently we got moved to some places that just weren't any fun. And Duluth, Minnesota is cold, really cold. And my oldest sister got married. I was 11 years old. We had a big reception for her. And the colonel said everybody could have a little sip of champagne at the reception. And there were so many people there, nobody was paying attention to me. 11-year-old boy, you know, I was just doing whatever I was doing. We all went by the fountain to toast my sister, and I got that little cup of champagne, and everybody, you know, toasted her. And, you know, my sisters, and still to this day, said they sipped theirs and watched me gulp mine. And, man, that was it. That was it, you know. I didn't need anything else except for nobody to be watching that champagne fountain for a while, because I kept going back by there and saying, that was pretty good. And about five of them into it, they started paying attention to me because I was spinning around, and they were like, what's with this little boy? And they put me to bed, and the bed was spinning, and my stomach was spinning, and, you know the story. I threw up. And but the whole thing was, when I got up or I came to the next morning, you know, my head was just killing me. I mean, I had a little man in there with a sledgehammer and an anvil just pounding away with the worst headache in the world. And I could taste that stale vomit. And, man, I hear it all the time. And I'm the same way. I just couldn't wait to do it again. I couldn't wait to get that feeling of out-of-control spinning again. And I chased that feeling for an awful long time. I mean, you would think somebody that had some intelligence would have stopped somewhere along the line, but I didn't. We moved down here in 1966. I found people that were a little bit older than me but did the things that I like to do, and I like to get drunk. I like to smoke cigarettes, and then I graduated. And this is Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to focus on alcoholism. I do believe in the traditions of it. It is an open meeting, so drugs are part of my story, and every now and then drugs will slip in there since I did an awful lot of them. But I met the people that, you know, it wasn't like they talked me into doing things. I wanted to do this stuff. I wanted to get out, slip out late at night and steal stuff and cars and things like that. And, you know, my dad's in Vietnam most of the time when we first moved down here. And, you know, my mom's got six kids. Five of them are doing pretty good, and one of them's out of control. Well, there's a little building up on Michigan called the Juvenile Detention Facility, and that's 13, 14, and 15. I spent most of my youth, when I wasn't free, I was in juvenile detention. And I learned something there. You still had to go to school. I always wanted to get out of going to school, but you still had to go to school there. But they taught me burglary. You know, that's what I learned in juvenile detention, is how to, I don't know about rehabilitation, but it wasn't happening then. You know, in the 60s, you know, you were going for punishment, and I went for punishment, and the guys there were telling me how to break into houses and things like that, and I thought, well, that, you know, it was a career for me. And I came out of the juvenile detention, and for the next 4 years, I was a burglar. And I don't say this jokingly, but it is, you know, comes out that way. But if you or your parents lived in Central Florida between 1968 and 72, I'm sorry. You know, if you got broke into, I probably did it because my group was not, it was kind of like alcoholism. We didn't have any discrimination. If your house was unlocked or your windows were easily to get into, I was there because I wanted your stuff so I could trade it for booze because I wanted to be drunk. And I wanted to be drunk all the time, and I was very successful at it, except that I never wore any gloves. And, eventually I broke into enough houses that they were taking fingerprints, and sure enough, one day the police were knocking at my door, and they were saying, "You're going to jail." And I was 17 at the time, and they took me to jail for burglary and a number of other offenses that they found out I did. And I tell you, jail was not fun. Everybody knows that that's been there, but I didn't like jail at all, and I just begged my father. He'd gotten back from Nam, begged him to, put up the bond. I was done being that kind of a person, and just get me out, one more time. Get me out of trouble, Daddy, one more time, And he did. And that night when they went to bed, I broke into his gun cabinet and the 45 automatic that he carried through World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. I put it in my back pocket, and I went over the back wall, and I took off and jumped bail. $5,000 he lost within 24 hours on me. So I hauled ass to California. Went on a burglary spree in California, along with a few other things out there. And I wound up in a military hospital with serum hepatitis. I was an IV drug user at the time, and I wasn't really smart enough to know that you're supposed to use clean needles and things like that. So I wound up with hepatitis C and almost died in a military hospital when I was 17 years old. And the reason I was in a military hospital is because I still had an ID card, and that's where my friends who were with me, and I was turning yellow and looking pretty bad. They dumped me off at the base, and, nobody wanted to touch me until they got me to the hospital. And then it was like, it was pretty serious. I really felt like I was going to die. I know I should have died, but I didn't. Sure enough, I moved up to Minnesota again. I don't know why on my own, but I went to Minnesota, and I was doing things up in Minnesota I shouldn't have been. And I got out of there pretty quick and got back down to Florida to visit some friends. And they were having a party at somebody's house that wasn't supposed to be having a party. And the parents, it was the people who used to own Walker Chemical that Massey Chemical bought out, and pretty well-known people with a nice house on Lake Maitland. The parents went out of town, told their sons don't have a party. And they didn't tell their sons, they told the police they weren't supposed to have a party, too. So here I am wanted for interstate flight to avoid prosecution, burglary, breaking and entering, assault, carrying a concealed weapon, a number of other offenses. And the police show up at the party, and, I'm drunk. I've done some pink little pills that a guy had there, and called phenocycladine, and they're animal tranquilizers is what it is, and I wanted to be drunk and crazy, so I took a bunch of those, and then I bought a gun while I was at the party. And, next thing I know, there's the police coming up the stairs, and there I am holding a gun in my hand, and I remember the police officer, his name was Butch Doyle. He wound up being the chief of police and retiring the Maitland Police Department. I'd like to say his arresting me probably got a promotion, but I don't think he did. But I was holding a loaded gun, pointing it at him, and he was pointing one at me, and we both were in this standoff thing that, my recollection, it went on for minutes with him yelling, "Drop it," and I thought we were being ripped off by a bunch of drug dealers, because I'd had that happen up in Minnesota, and I was pointing mine at him saying, "Drop it," and God, I don't know why he didn't shoot me. I really don't know why. And I don't think he knows why either, but he didn't. And I dropped mine, went back to jail again. And this time there was no bond. And I had hepatitis again. Even though I'd spent almost 6 months in a hospital in California, I didn't learn anything. I went right back to IV drug using again and dirty needles and everything else. And I was in an isolation cell, and I went before a judge. And I really didn't think I'd done, all that stuff until that prosecutor started reading all that stuff. And then I realized that I've done a lot of stuff. And I'm 17, or no, I just turned 18 years old, and the judge looked at me and said, you know, I'm going to sentence you to 52 years in the state penitentiary in Rayford, Florida. And, man, I was floored. I had known people who had gone up to Rayford. I'd never seen them again. You know, they'd never come back from Rayford. And I knew that place was a pretty awful place. And I knew an 18-year-old boy going up there was going to have a hard time, because I'm a lot fatter and bigger than I used to be, because I wasn't very big, and it was not something I was looking forward to. And they took me back to that isolation cell, and the only book that they allowed you to have, and I don't know if AA was doing jail meetings at the time or not, but they weren't coming into, you know, hepatitis rooms, that's for sure. And so I had a Bible, and that was the first time I remembered that. I just grabbed a hold of that Bible. It's like, dear God, help me, you know, help me. And he always had helped me before. I believed in God before I ever got here. And so those words up here didn't scare me off like they do a lot of people that either, you know, don't believe in God, or God didn't treat them right, or whatever, you know. But I begged God, you know, for 2 weeks. And I went back before a judge, and he said, you might have a chance. You know, I'm going to change my mind. I'm going to give you 18 months on a chain gang. And where 33rd Street Jail is, there used to be a small building there. And all the rest of that was nothing but fields. And we grew our own food. We did our own cows. And 6 days a week, you got up before sunrise. You ate, got in the back of an open-ended truck with chains around it. You weren't going to escape. And if you ever seen the movie with Paul Newman and Cool Hand Luke, that was us. I mean, that's what we did 6 days a week. Sun up to sundown, you were in the ditch. You were using I see my buddy Ron here, using a Kaiser blade is what they call it. You know, it's a swing blade. But I drive down the interstate now, and I see these prisoners out there with weed eaters and blowers, and it's like, not in 1972 they didn't do that. You had things that made you want to not be there. And you know, I just came right out of isolation cell. It was July. I was falling down, you know, and I couldn't keep up with anybody, and the heat was getting to me, and you would think that if you were passing out, they would go ahead and send a truck out and take you back to the prison farm, and they put you underneath the truck in the ant beds, and that's where you kind of hung out until the end of the day. And that happened like 4 days in a row before I figured out to slow down, take the salt tablets, drink the water, and try to keep up with everybody, but it was miserable. And I did not want to be out there, and I didn't care what anybody called me. I saw trustees, and I saw them sharpening the blades and them hanging around the truck in the shade. So I did my best to impress on the boss that, you know, I needed to be a trustee, you know. And eventually, nobody got sentenced to more than 2 or 3 years at that time. At the Orange County Correctional Institute is what they called it. It was really a chain gang. They'd just taken the chains off of us. They were getting progressive, but you still had guards at each end of the line with shotguns, and you still weren't. If you wanted to run, have at it. I had no interest in running. I mean, it was a guaranteed 5 years in prison, and I was trying to make my time there. But I became a trustee, and then as I saw what was going on inside the building, I really worked as hard as I could to convince them that I knew how to cook. Because, you know, if you cook, you had to get up early, but you're cooking for 150 people, and so you're inside a building all day. You're not out in that hot sun. And so I was able to make my way into the building and make my way from dishwasher into prep cook into a cook. And, you know, I had already known something from my redneck days and some of the things that people had taught me, and that was how to make what prisoners call buck. If you've ever been to jail and got lucky enough to get drunk in jail on something they made there, it was not moonshine, because that was kind of hard to make where we were, but feeding 150 people, you could put all that stuff together into a container and hide it and let it ferment, and rotten grapefruit, I remember, is what we used as our filler to make, you know, the fermentation start a little stronger, and we drained it through a sock. I think it was a clean sock. I couldn't guarantee. Good guarantee, and didn't care at the time. I just knew that when it came out of that sock, I was going to get drunk, and that's exactly what happened. And I continued to make that for as long as I could while I was in the kitchen, because we were allowed, the cooks were allowed to go around the cell block at night, and if we had bologna sandwiches left over, we could sell them, you know, for a quarter or 50 cents to the prisoners, because you're allowed to have your own money at the time. They allowed you to smoke, and they gave you cigarettes. And so I made a small little living in prison off of selling alcohol, you know, and it wasn't very good tasting. And in the doctor's opinion, you know, that was one of my great convincers when I got here, was it talks about right there that men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. It doesn't say anywhere in there they like the taste, and they just like the effect, and that was me. And I was an alcoholic then, and for a long time after that I was an alcoholic. I served my time. I got out. I had a little bit of probation to do. I served that. I never got caught, really, during my probation time, but to show you my age, and I hate to do that, I got pulled over 3 different times after I got off probation for DUI, and I refused to blow. And the first time, they suspended my license for 30 days. Second time, they suspended my license for 30 days. And the third time, they suspended my license for 90 days. Now, that was back in the days. You don't blow now, you don't get your license for a year, and it's about $15,000, I think, for your first DUI right now. So I got lucky. You know, I didn't have to go back to jail. I moved to a little town in Mississippi with a friend of mine where I met my ex-wife. And years later, after we got through counseling, which we signed up for 12 sessions when I was getting ready to get a divorce, which was 21 years of marriage. You know, we didn't make it past the second session before I'd heard that, you know, I never dated my wife. You know, I never took her to the movies. We never went to dinner. I didn't meet the parents. You know, nothing like that. She came over to the house. She was dating a friend of mine that was managing one Pizza Hut. I was managing another Pizza Hut, and she didn't have a place to stay, and I said she could stay on the couch, and some friends from Florida came up, and I said, well, she could stay in my room, and we won't do anything, and we got drunk, we got some Valiums in us, and off comes the clothes, and that was our first date, you know. Drunk and naked was how I dated my wife. And never knew that either. You know, I hated it. You know, 21 years later, that's what she remembered. And I kind of remembered all kinds of fun things that I don't remember now, but I'm, you know, I thought we had a good life. And we did have a good life. I mean, I've got to admit that she did stay with an alcoholic for 21 years because I was an alcoholic then. But I didn't think I was. I mean, I really didn't think I had a drinking problem. I did a lot of drugs. I did every drug there was except crack, because they came out with crack after I had, you know, retired. But I never retired from alcohol. You know, I got rid of all the drugs because of the business I got into. You really couldn't have that in you. But alcohol, that was a big deal in the real estate industry. And so, you know, I had no problem drinking in the evening. And that's why I didn't think I was an alcoholic when I got here, is because I didn't wake up in the morning with the shakes. I didn't have to have a drink to go to work. You know, I didn't have to have all these things that other people I hear had. But when I got off at 5 o'clock, I started putting down my drink. And, you know, my drink of choice was Schlitz malt liquor. And like I said, it doesn't say anything about taste in this book. You know, it talks about effect. And that's generally what I was shooting for, is effect. And I could get pretty hammered every night. And I did that for a long, long, long time. And I look at it now and I just wonder, you know, how I'm still alive after all that. But we went along. Everything was, you know, in my mind, everything was great. In her mind, it sucked, because, you know, she was spending the night with a drunk every night. And I remember doing crazy things. You know, I didn't think I was crazy when I got here. That's why I kept drinking after I got here, because I just couldn't get that step two thing, because I wasn't insane. But, you know, I did things like I'd get drunk every night, but I liked sugar. You know, I liked sweets. And so I'd eat a piece of cake or some ice cream or something like that. And about 2 o'clock in the morning, man, my head would be throbbing, because mixing that alcohol with that sugar right then, it wasn't good for you, and there was only one way, and I don't mean to gross anybody out, but there's only one way to get rid of that, and that was put your finger down your throat and throw up, and then, you know, I didn't understand why she didn't want to kiss me when I went back to bed, and she put up with a lot. We were married 17 years. We'd lost three babies. She had lost three babies through ectopic pregnancies, and then she got pregnant again, and in 8 months, she was going through the exact same thing that we'd lost the other babies. We were rushing her to the hospital. She was bleeding, and the doctor said, "You're about to have a baby," you know, and it was like, that was a really cool experience because I wasn't drunk at that time, you know, for some reason, and I got to be in the delivery room. I got to catch my son as he came out of my wife, which is, man, what a thrill that was. I was like, wow. This is cool. You know, and I proceeded to go home while she did her thing at the hospital and got drunk then. And I was really happy. Son came home, he, you know, premature baby, so we were real careful with him and all. And then it just came the time where my drinking was just more than she could handle. And my drinking had progressed, and I didn't know anything about progression or anything else. So, like I said, all that I've learned here. But my sister was dying from bone marrow cancer at the time. And she had a bunch of Percodan, and she lived a lot longer than she should have because of some experiments they did on her. And my back was going out from work I'd done earlier, and I'd done some Percodan and drank, you know, a lot in my life, and it was no big deal. But then for some reason, one night it happened, you know. Here I am taking a couple Percodan and getting drunk. And I don't know if it's ever happened to anybody else. I never assumed that it has. But if you take a sedative and you put a lot of alcohol on it, sometime about 2 o'clock in the morning, your bladder says get up and your brain doesn't hear it. And I woke up to this screaming woman yelling, "You pissed all over me, you pissed all over me." And I didn't know it. I mean, you know, I'm asleep. And I would have just as soon gone back to sleep if she had let me, but we had to get up and get the mattresses turned over and all that, and I thought I'd be nice the next day and go buy her a brand new mattress, since ours was about 20 years old anyway, and I spent $250 on a brand new mattress, and I didn't marry a dumb girl. She spent $20 on a plastic mattress cover. She thought it was going to happen again. I never believed it was going to happen again, and about a week later it happened again, and about a week later after that, and after about the fourth or fifth time I was doing that, it was like I was back, I was 2 years old. I was just wet in the bed every night. She decided she had enough. And she said she wanted a divorce. And I said, okay, you know, I'll give you a divorce. Not only that, I'll pay for the divorce and I'll give you anything you want. And you got to understand, you know, I got a little boy. The only thing I ever wanted in my life was my little boy. He was 4 years old. And she said, I'm taking the boy with me. And I said, all right, go ahead. You know, I traded my little boy to stay in the bottle for another few years. And somewhere in the book it says that great events will come to you and countless others, you know, if you abandon yourself to God as you understand Him. And one of the greatest events that happened to me was a couple of years ago. My son told me that he forgave me. I'm about to leak. That he's been to thousands of AA meetings. A lot of y'all know him because he works a coffee bar here when he's here on vacations in springtime. But he said that, you know, he understood that I was sick when I gave him up. And I was real lucky. The guy that she was online trying to get, I think I'm one of the first person that actually had a wife that was online with a love affair. But, you know, it really happened. And she fell in love with some guy on the computer. It was her best friend's ex-husband back in the little town that I met her. And he's a great guy. I mean, my son's stepfather is a wonderful man. I got lucky. I really got lucky because he treats him like a son. He takes him hunting, does a lot of things with him. And it was a wonderful thing that happened. But, you know, when I look back on giving him up, you know, I didn't fight for him. I didn't try to keep him. And he didn't get taken from him. I gave him up. Just like everything I don't have that I used to have, I never lost anything in Alcoholics Anonymous, or due to alcoholism, I didn't lose anything. I gave it away. I freely gave away what I had to continue to be drunk. At that time that we were getting the divorce, it was recommended that I come to Alcoholics Anonymous by my stepmother. And so I did, but I didn't come here to get sober. I didn't come here to stop drinking. A friend of mine killed himself. He was 4 years younger than me. He got tough loved out of his house, and he committed suicide and burned himself up in his car. And I went to his funeral, and I was just overcome with everything that was going on in my life. And so I made the decision that I'd driven by this place, the little house next door, but this place, I'd driven by it thousands of times because my office is right across the street. And I thought it was a labor pool. You know, I'd see all these people standing outside. I thought it was a labor pool. I had no idea what it was. And I called a friend of mine and said, you know, I'm thinking about going to an AA meeting. He goes, well, there's one across the street from your office. And I'm like, oh, that's what they are over there. So I came in here crying. And I came here for one reason. I came here to tell a room full of old men in trench coats that smell like alcohol, that's who I thought you were. I came in to tell y'all that if you didn't quit drinking, that you're probably going to commit suicide. And I walked into a room full of people looking just like yourself right now, and there's a man sitting there with 30 years sobriety, and a little girl named Julie happened to be sitting next to me, and she was saying it's going to be all right. And I was just in tears. And I left that meeting. A guy stalked me down the street and said, you know, why don't you come back? And I said, why don't you leave me alone? You know, I don't... I came back. You know, I don't know why. You know, I came back. And for 27 days, I kept coming into this room and crying because I couldn't quit drinking. I didn't hear you saying get a sponsor. I didn't hear anything about the life-saving measures these steps were going to have in my life when I finally did get sober. I just kept coming back. And the old man Leo, it was a Friday afternoon. It was my 27th day. I was crying, and he pulled me aside afterwards, and he said, why don't you just go home and drink a bottle of arsenic? I'm tired of you coming in here and bragging how you can drink. And I was pissed off at that old man. I mean, I don't know how many people he got sober on a resentment. That was the first time in over 30 years that I didn't go home and take a drink or a drug. And I came in the next day and picked up a white chip. And I'd like to say that was the only white chip I picked up, but I didn't. I continued to come in and out of the program. I would feel better. I would overstate my alcoholism. I didn't have that big of a problem. And then I'd go back out, and when they talk about the progressive of the disease, they're not kidding. It's there. It's waiting for you. It's waiting for me. And I always thought, well, if I go back and I just start slowly, and it just never happened with me. Every time I went back and I started drinking again, I picked up right where I was, and that was drinking to get drunk. I went 9 months without taking a drink coming to AA. I said I had a sponsor. I said I was working the steps, and I was in my own mind, but I wasn't working the program, and that was the difference, is I was not working this program. And I came to a Saturday night speaker meeting. A guy came up here and actually told my story. And the guy who brought me to the speaker meeting said, why don't you go shake his hand afterwards? And, you know, people crowd around speakers sometimes. And I just said, he's busy, you know. I'll get with him later on. And Dan wouldn't let me get with him later on, so he kind of walked me through the middle of this crowd of people. And he said, hey, Joe, this is my friend Jim. I think he needs a sponsor. And, I was stuck. You know, there I am, shaking the guy's hand, saying, I drank Schlitz malt liquor, too, and I'm not a racist at all. I might be a redneck, but, all I knew is, you know, Schlitz malt liquor was not something any of my friends drank. You know, it just wasn't. It's what I drank. And I took out my business card, and on the back side of it, I wrote my phone number down. I asked him, would you sponsor me? And he said, well, are you done drinking? And I said, yeah. I just picked up a 9-month shift at the meeting, and I'm pretty sure I'm done. And he took out his business card, and on the white side, he wrote his phone number down. And I was still kind of stupid because I said, if you want to sponsor me, why don't you call me on Monday? And that's not the way it works, folks. But what did work was when we turned those two business cards over, we both worked for Cobalt Banker Real Estate. He worked in the Winter Park office in New Home Sales. I worked in the Orlando office in commercial real estate. And I'd never met him in my life. And I had no clue that, you know, this was a God shot. And I knew it. And I knew right then it was a God shot. And so we made plans to meet on Monday to go ahead and start working the steps. And on Sunday, I decided that I could take one drink of alcohol. I could do it. You know, 9 months, I could do it. And when I came to on my kitchen floor Monday morning, half of a half gallon was gone, and I didn't spill any of it, and I didn't know what the hell was going on. And I didn't think he was going to sponsor me, and I called him, and he told me, pour out the rest of the alcohol. I'll meet you at a noon meeting, pick up a white chip, and let's work the steps and see if your life won't change. And that's exactly what we did, and that was my road to recovery right there. And sobriety and recovery are not the same thing. Sobriety is part of recovery. Because once I got rid of the alcohol, there was an awful lot of gym left inside. And that was the part that I had to work on. I never really paid attention that I had an ego out of control or I was self-centered. I knew I was a liar, you know, and I knew I stole, but I hadn't done that in a lot of years. But we started working the steps. And I work with people now because that's what my sponsor suggested that I do when I got back from Georgia. I found a dream in Georgia, and I thought it was the greatest dream in the world, and I own it. And my brother's up there, my older brother's up there right now. But when my younger brother was diagnosed and going to die, I decided that I needed to come back. I needed to be around you people. I'm in the middle of nowhere, Georgia, 60 miles to get to a meeting, and I just needed to be around alcoholics because I was not thinking about drinking. But I didn't know if that wasn't going to happen if I stayed up there. And for some reason, God brought me back. And once he brought me back, then I started working with people. And it's been the greatest thrill in my life to be able to watch the light come on in somebody else's eyes. You know, to see that little flicker of hope to a guy who walks in here just like me, crying and saying, I can't quit drinking. I don't know what to do. And it's a matter of let's sit down, let's start, you know, looking at These steps are very important. You know, I heard things like, you know, when do you reach your bottom? You know, people would say, you know, when did you reach your bottom? And I said, when I put my shovel down. When I stop digging the hole, I put my shovel down. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, what they'll do for you when you put the shovel down and you ask for help is they'll put a ladder down in that hole. And all you got to do is walk these steps up that ladder to get out of that hole and get your life back. Now, they did tell me there was a couple steps that I was going to have to build myself. One was the fourth. The other was the ninth. But I wanted out of that hole. And that hole's still there. You know, it doesn't get eroded. There's no water that fills it up. It's still there. It's waiting for me to pick that shovel up again. And I don't want to. I don't want to drink today. I don't have a desire to drink today. I have a desire to live a life that God has given me. You know, I didn't get justice. I got grace. God gave me grace because I worked the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous to the best of my ability, not just once, not just twice. I work them in my life. And, yeah, my ego jumps out. Yeah, I take my will back. And I'm not perfect. I'm never going to be perfect. And I don't want to be perfect. But I do want to just keep progressing in the program. You know, I don't want to progress in a disease anymore. And when I got back, I got really into Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, this is what it's called a textbook, you know, and in the textbook, that's to learn from. And, you know, in the first 25 pages, there's two little asterisks on the bottom, and one of them says you might see Appendix 2, and the next one says you should see Appendix 2, and by page 47, the asterisk says, please read Appendix 2, and so Bill and Bob are trying to tell you to look at that spiritual experience in the back of the book, you know, and I didn't have that, and I'll try not to say white lightning experience, but I didn't have that white light experience. But I started seeing things, and I do this with my sponsees. I said, don't look, you know, for that big flaming bush or anything like that. Look for little things like this, because God is all around you, and he's giving you little flickers of light, of hope. If you can just stop drinking long enough to get your mind clear, if you can understand that this book was written by a couple of drunks, with the help of a few other drunks, four drunks. And that's all I am, as a drunk. You know, I'm a sober drunk, but that's all I am. I'm just a drunk, a common, ordinary, everyday, drank too much, couldn't stop drinking drunk. And, yeah, they designed this program for me. They designed it simple enough that all I had to do is follow some steps, look at myself, get rid of some of that crap, and on a daily basis, work 6 and 7, ask God to take those defects away from me, work 10, 11, and 12. I don't really need to go to bed tonight with any anger. I don't, you know, if I want to, that's a choice, but I choose not to today. You know, I do the simple things that I hear people 30 years still do, you know. I ask God every day to keep me away from a drink of alcohol. That stuff will kill me, and I know that. And I should have been dead, and if there's some reason God's got me here, that's one of the reasons is for me to, you know, pass this thing on. And I didn't know when I got here, and nobody told me you're going to have a responsibility when you get sober. I do know that, you know, when you got to the 12th step that you were supposed to start giving this away. My sponsor and I both agree that you don't have to get to the 12th step to start giving this thing away. You know, a guy with 15 days can help a newcomer out. He can tell him that, you know, I've been, because when you're first getting sober, 15 days is a long, long time. You know, you might look at people and say, 30 years, oh well, but that guy who's got 15 days, how did you do 15 days? That's, you know, so you don't have to have years of sobriety. You know, all you have to do is have the program. All you have to do is understand that this was designed to keep alcoholics alive. And it's one drunk talking to another drunk. That's what the program's all about. Where doctors telling me I was going to die didn't get me from drinking. It was one alcoholic talking to me about how they got sober and how they stay sober one day at a time. You know, when you first come in here and you think the rest of my life, oh my God. No. You know, the rest of your life could be today. Because in the big, big book and in this big book, I've not yet found a place where it says that there's a guarantee that you're going to wake up tomorrow. There's just no guarantees. And so you're getting one day at a time. When you get up in the morning, if you're not coming to, if you're actually waking up and remembering where your car is, then, you know, just sit there and say, God, keep me away from a drink, you know, just for today. Help me not be selfish and self-centered. Help me help somebody else. And the responsibility thing that I know now is that I'm responsible as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and especially Central Orlando, I'm responsible that anywhere, anyone, and that there's no limit. There is no classification. There is no color barrier. There's no sexual barrier. I only work with men because that's all I only know about men stuff. Women should work with women because they know women stuff. But, you know, I'm responsible to reach my hand out if somebody reaches their hand out and says, I need help. Because when I reached my hand out, the hand of AA was there for me. And I'm responsible to do the same thing to the next alcoholic that comes through this room, because I don't know whether or not my son will get this. You know, I believe it's hereditary. He might have the opportunity to get it. He's seen what it does to people. But if he gets it, I want these rooms to be open. I want these doors to be open for your children, for my children, for anybody's children. When the time comes that they reach out their hand and say, you know, I've got a problem with drinking and I can't stop, I want somebody to reach out their hand and say, you know, let me show you how I did it. You know, let me show you how I worked the steps with God's grace. And my life is amazing. You know, my life is totally amazing. There's not enough time for me to go into everything in my life, but I can tell you this, that when I hear the amazing grace, you know, that's me. And the guy who wrote that song, if you don't know, was a slave captain bringing slaves over from Africa. He wrote the words to Amazing Grace. And I was a slave to alcohol. And God gave me amazing grace to give me the ability to stand up here tonight and tell you how much I love you and I love this program. And thank you for letting me be here.
I'm still Shannon. I'm still an alcoholic. I told you. See why I love him? That was wonderful. I knew it would be. Thank you so much, Jim.